call the Senate Health and Social Services Committee to order. Today is Tuesday, March 3rd, 2026, and the time is 3:30 p.m. Members present, Senator Myers, Senator Klayman, Senator Tobin, and myself, Vice Chair Senator Giesel. Senator Dunbar, who is the chair of the committee, is on the phone. If he has any questions, of course, he'll chime in during the meeting. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. Thank you to Marigwin and to Susan, who are helping us out with minutes and audio. So today, our one item is a presentation from the Office of Children's Services on their 2025 audit report. So I will invite forward today Kim Guay, Director of the Office of Children's Services, and Tracy Dompling, who is the Acting Commissioner, Department of Family and Children's Services. So welcome to the committee. Be sure to introduce yourself for the record, and each time you alternate speakers, if you would identify yourself. So thanks for being here.
Great. Thank you for the record. Tracy Dompling, Acting Commissioner for the Department of Family and Community Services. Thanks for the opportunity today. Director Guay is going to be primarily running the show today, but just again wanted to say thank you.
For the record, my name is Kim Guay. I'm the Director of Office of Children's Services, and thank you for the opportunity to share on House Bill 151. So this first slide is a little bit of a timeline of House Bill 151 on foster care reform. And so it was passed unanimously in June of 2018. And I'm going to go through different components. When this passed in 2018, it had three audits that were required under this legislation. So I'm going to go through those and ask questions as needed. Part one of the House Bill 151 started in 18. The first one was audit was done in 2020, November of 2020. The audit came with four different recommendations, and those four different recommendations are on these next two slides. So the first one is OCS director should implement supervisor certification procedures for relative and family friend searches. We have completed the policies and procedures. We do have, we did training on this. We also have been working with our Alaska Child Welfare Compact, and so our tribes are also helping with relative searches. I am happy to say that we are leading the nation on children placed with relatives. So while it's hard to say, what you'll see later in part three is that there was not a supervisor certification that there are relatives in a case. However, we have a report that we can pull up, and 98% of our cases have relatives associated with them, and we have children placed with relatives fairly high compared to the nation. So we're pretty proud of those numbers, but we do not have the supervisor certification checkoff, and I'll talk about that a little bit later. I won't read verbatim the recommendations, but if you have questions on recommendations 1 through 4 on audit one, please let me know. There's many of these, to back up a bit, many of the audit recommendations are technical in nature. The law that passed in 2018, I mean, even the word reform, right? Reform is much different than some of the audit recommendations. And so many of these audit recommendations, as they were searching through things, they found things such as, when people exited OCS, we did not, there wasn't the right paperwork when they started, that we couldn't produce it. So they're like, where was the paperwork to get online access into your computer system? So they made that as a recommendation, for example. So the audit, while important, it didn't get to the what people call the heart of 151, which really was about caseload capping. And you'll see nowhere in part one, two, or three of the audit does it really talk about caseload capping, which is something that we've continued to try to achieve. But when there's more cases than there is workers, the math isn't mathing on this one. And so that's kind of the heart of part of our problems. And so audit, the recommendations 3 and 4 change the training requirements for our licensing. So we had to update some regulations, which we did. We also put out training in regards to regulation for training. These are training plans for our foster parents. So foster parents need ongoing training supports, or they have a child that's been placed with them with ADHD. We want to make sure that we're educating them on what that could look like. And this last one is the one I talked about, the security changes. When they were auditing us, they found that there were some staff that we couldn't produce the documents that gave them online access, or we didn't close their account down fast enough after they left. So they recommended we put in a quarterly report, and then you'll see later on we change it from quarterly to monthly to make sure that we're catching those folks that have exited. I mean, they still don't have access, but we need to make sure that it's they're completely exited from our computer system. So as I mentioned, part one. Yes, go ahead.
Excuse me. Senator Tobin, question.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I apologize. Would you like questions during the slides or at the end of the presentation?
Through the chair, during the slides would be great.
Perfect.
Yeah. At the end of each slide.
Yes, that'd be great.
Perfect.
Well, then, Senator Tobin.
Thank you, Madam Chairwoman. Mine are actually pertaining to slides three, where you have in recommendation one regarding the ORCA system, and I know we've had some conversations around using rural health transformation funds to improve the ORCA system. So I see here that you talk about how you made changes to the system. Can you talk about what improvements are needed or necessary to continue to work on this particular recommendation?
Through the chair, Senator Tobin, thank you for the question. So ORCA was developed in 2004. Not 24, that would be great. 2004. So it's a very aging system. We have done a study, commissioned a study to look at our system, and they came back with some options. The options are expensive, which is why we're going down the rural health transformation point right now. And the federal government has come back and said it's not up to par, and they've reduced our spending allowance on trying to change our system. So usually with any changes that we do in ORCA, we get reimbursed by the federal government 50%. Right now we're at 35% because we have not been able to update our system. Some of the difficulties with recommendation one, for example, the request was once you need to focus on relative searches, which we have done and we've trained about it. We are working with tribes on it. We have a lot of relatives in our system. What was asked specifically is that supervisors go in and certify through a note. And that's one of the, when we were looking at this years ago, a couple of years ago, like how can we implement this? The cost to make what I would consider kind of minor modifications to an aging system are to the tune of around $1 million to $2 million. And so when we're looking at that, you know, I also try to be judicious with our fiscal dollars. What we're seeing is we do have relative placements. We're doing great. Do I need to spend $2 million to show what I can show that we are? And so we chose not to have a checkbox that becomes automated, which is one of the recommendations. Somehow the supervisors need to be certifying this. But I can tell you when I run reports, I have relatives in there. We have high relative placement numbers. And so that's kind of some of the I think where we had some rub on that, right? And I will say, you know, it is part of the law that we're supposed to be certifying, so we didn't meet that criteria, although sometimes laws don't always make sense. And it was fiscally just not responsible for me to be doing that. So we did not do that one. So I don't know if that answers your question, Senator Tobin, but that was one of the ones that kind of was a little different.
Commissioner Dopling?
Thank you. For the record, Tracy Dompling, through the chair to Representative, or excuse me, Senator Tobin. Just to add a little bit more maybe on your question that we are looking at then what could we do kind of to improve the system. I know Director Guay has talked about having portals that would be available where a foster parent would be able to go into a portal to have reports that could be run when an individual is maybe going, a child is going into a foster home so that you have the information readily available for the foster parent. I've also heard pediatricians even requesting if there would be a report that could be printed out so that when a foster parent is bringing a youth to a at their pediatric appointment, that they have that information that's there and they're not having to rely on the information that's either, you know, been passed through the foster parent, you know, and especially if it's a stressful situation. So I think we've got a lot of opportunity. And then just seeing the opportunity to kind of go beyond how that goes beyond just the ORCA system and the work that it does within child welfare, but also really expanding that good, you know, health practices into the community when children are needing care.
Did that help, Senator Tobin?
That does. I have a second question, if that's all right,
Madam Senator Tobin.
Thank you. And so also on this recommendation one, I know there is a piece of legislation that has been being considered by the body, and it's particularly around the timeliness of relative and family searches. We've heard from some public testimony that folks don't feel like it's happening very quickly, that it's taking a long time. And I've heard from a few folks say that they had a child placed in their home. The process to find a family member took years. And when that child was replaced back with a family member, it really harmed the foster family. And just curious a little bit about the timeliness component here and what work you've been doing to ensure that those searches are happening in a timely fashion and that they are very thorough.
Through the chair, Senator Tobin, we have a federal statute that requires us to do relative search within the first 30 days a child comes into custody. So, and in addition, we have the team decision-making meeting. So when a child comes into custody, we gather people to the table to talk about relative placements. Typically, children are placed with relatives initially. The data, and I would have to get you current data, but as of around a year or so ago, we're seeing a lot more children placed with relatives initially. And then the change of placement happens a little bit after that. And then sometimes children go into foster care. But we do see relatives up front. And I think that there's some of the efforts that we're trying to do is help support relatives when they get placement, because these children are coming with trauma. And sometimes, you know, they're unlicensed, meaning that, you know, they can get relative ATAP, which is a fairly low dollar amount, or they can go through the licensure process with OCS, which takes a couple months. Fostering children is difficult. It's often thankless work. And so really trying to figure out how do we prop up our foster parents, because it can be extremely difficult doing some of this work. And so that's one of the things that we've been trying to work on through a variety of sources. We stood up a placement search and support unit because what our foster parents were telling us is, you know, sometimes we're having emergencies and it's at 7 o'clock at night. And so we now, you know, we have people answering the phone until 8 o'clock at night. We have been working with our foster parents to hold foster care forums to figure out what it is. And they're the ones that said, we need this placement support, search and support unit. And so we've really been trying to meet our foster parents where they're at. In addition, you know, 2024, July 1 of 2024, we were able to give them a 30% increase to our foster care base rates. So we are trying to get more relatives, kin, and foster parents to the table. But it is extremely daunting work. But I can get you specific data on that if you would like to see that.
Follow up, Senator Tobin.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chairwoman. And I would love to talk with you offline about the disparity between a kinship placement not having the same support financially as a foster family. I think that sounds like that might be a barrier for kinship placement.
Thank you. We will do that.
All right. Are we on slide 5?
Yes,
looks like it. Very good.
So
Director Gui.
For the record, Director Gui, Office of Children's Services. So audit one, part one was 2020. And then as you all know, we hit the pandemic. And so we didn't see the audit again until 2023. So between November 2020 to the part audit two of the audit, we were hard at work trying to figure out how we can help achieve better outcomes. And so one of the very first things on this slide is the governor's People First initiative. The governor met with us and said, what can we do to help? He was able to get us retention bonuses for our existing line staff. We were able to get additional positions to help family contact and all the things that are needed behind the scenes, some admin support type positions. We also launched the Occupational Endorsement Child Welfare Certificate through UAA. which has been fantastic. So we are paying our staff to attend this program so they can understand child welfare. Because what we've seen in the last 5 years is people are coming to OCS with less education than they have in the past. 5 years ago, around 80% of our staff were degreed, and we are at around 50% right now are degreed, and the rest do not have ongoing education. So we are trying to prop up our staff, the ones that are coming in that would like to get some education. We're helping pay for them to understand at least child welfare. They're getting academic credits in hopes that they, too, would like to go on to get a minor or a bachelor's degree. So that's one thing that we've been working hard at. We also, during the People's First, our own staff have burnout and secondary trauma from the things they hear and see. So we are able to stand up a wellness and resiliency officer. We also have a safety department that oversees our safety because we do experience a lot of threats and things of that nature. We also stood up critical incident debriefing when unfortunate things happen on your case and how they can impact you. So we are working on trying to get staff in the door, make sure they're healthy, and stay on the job. And so we are working hard at retention of our staff by numerous initiatives. The last one on here is reflective supervision. So we're really trying to train our leadership on reflective supervision, meeting people where they're at, and then how to get to the priorities of what needs to be done. And so it has been a work in progress, but we've been hard at it trying to figure out our workforce issues because we have quite a few of them.
Senator Klayman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Specific to the workforce issues, what do you see as if you were to identify two of the biggest reasons you're having challenges with workforce recruiting and retention, what would be the top two reasons?
Through the chair, Senator Klayman, I love your question.
Good thing I didn't ask for three.
I can give you a few, but we'll stick to two. I will tell you, according to staff surveys and what staff are telling me, it's their pay. Their pay is not commensurate with the work that they're doing. There's not enough people coming to the table. They work a lot of overtime, and the things they're hearing and seeing, they're leaving quickly. And so their pay is fairly low. They make 28 and change an hour. So that is one of the things that they would tell you. Second one, it's a hard toss up because I may throw in a third one in there. A lot of the on-call work. So if you work all day and you have a very hard case, child abuse doesn't end at 5 o'clock, right? So we are having to work into the night. We're having to get called out. And then you have to show up the next day and start the same thing over again. Like, we don't have enough staff to not respond at night, right? Although we're not considered first responders, we don't get compensated as first responders, but our supervisors and our line staff are having to respond after hours, and it just never stops. So that is one that we're struggling with and what they say. And the third one, which I was kind of in a toss-up with, what I'm going to throw in there, I think our retirement system is a problem. You know, we're not creating, people don't stay long enough to know how to do this job, and this job takes a while to understand. It really is complex. You're in court, you're testifying, you're removing children. Our decision making is serious. I mean, we take children and we terminate parental rights, or we leave kids in unsafe situations, right? So really understanding the complexity of what we do, I don't know if it's an entry-level type position. It you really have to understand this work and stay around long enough. And that's not to say I can't bring in people that don't have bachelor's degrees, but they're also not coming with that work experience of working with vulnerable populations or understanding case management. Those aren't the people that are coming to OCS anymore. It's people that are, you know, stocking the shelves or, you know, making coffees. And so it's just a different population of people that we're seeing. So I hope that answered your question. And sorry, I went one over.
Follow up, Senator Klayman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A couple of years ago, facing some of the same challenges, the legislature passed statutes that increased the pay range in Department of Law specific to prosecutors. And the reports are that was raised has made a difference. is your sense that if we took a similar step in the legislature to increase the pay grades that would apply to OCS workers, that you would see a similar improvement in terms of recruiting and retention?
Through the chair, Senator Clayman, I believe so, with the caveat that this work is always going to be extremely hard, right? It's hard to hear. It's hard to see. We don't often get good press, but there are good things that happen, right? So we'll always have turnover, but I think it would reduce the turnover, and I think it would draw more people in.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Myers.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So to that last point, at my other job, my wife likes to remind me that the boring trips are the best ones. it's when things don't happen that's when we're thankful.
As long as you don't fall asleep at the wheel.
Exactly. I kind of want to go off a little bit on what you were saying about some of the training and stuff. You mentioned the endorsement here. I think you said that was at UAA.
Correct.
Okay. How long is that? Is that 6 months, a year? How long does it take to get that?
Through the chair, Senator Myers, it's a two-year program.
That's a two-year.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
And follow-up?
Yes, thank you. I'm curious, you talked about the difference in how your staff previously was coming in primarily had degrees, whereas a lot of your staff now does not. What do you think was in the training there as they got their degree that helped them cope better with the caseload, with the type of work being done?
Through the chair, Senator Myers, a lot of what we do takes professional writing. We have to write court reports. We have to submit things in writing to the – we have to be able to testify to laws. And so our – in addition to that, the people that we're serving, they have significant issues, whether it's substance abuse, mental health issues. So how to approach that through using motivational interviewing, how you produce hope. Like, those are things that I think that you learn within school, and understanding, like, the attachment theories that go behind, like, why children should be with their family first and foremost if they can't be with their parents. Like, these are things that we talk about and that you struggle with when you're learning in a safe environment through education. And we do see, I will say that some of my best folks that work for me, I have two managers that are not degreed, and they're great, but they came to us working in the communities in different parts of agencies, right? They were working with homeless populations or teens, and then they came in and they were started out off as like a social services associate, and then they've worked their way up. So it's definitely possible to come in and learn the job. We're just not seeing those people that used to work in the communities that have that work with that vulnerable population that we're looking for. And so I think that's one of our issues is, the pipeline. It seems like everyone is needing these workers, these social workers, whether they're master's levels, bachelor's levels. They're in high demand, and this is hard, thankless work. And so people aren't necessarily coming here.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Tobin.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chairwoman. And just to dig a little bit deeper into the education component, what are you anticipating or looking for in terms of that pipeline? I know with the changes that were made in HR 1, there are now caps on student loan borrowing for social workers, for folks with those advanced practice degrees. And we don't offer some of them here in the state. So is there an apprenticeship program that you're looking toward or some other states that might have interesting things we can crib off of?
Through the chair, Senator Tobin, to be honest with you, I have not looked at that thoroughly enough. We are concerned about a pipeline. We have contemplated, like, do we go outside of Alaska and try to recruit folks here? One of our hit hardest lately has been our Anchorage office, which is unusual because that used to be an area that we had a lot of applicants. But I believe that, being the biggest city in Alaska, they have more opportunities to do different things, right? So they're not necessarily coming to the Anchorage office. And we do recruit out of state, and we will pay for moving expenses to some degree. But what we typically find is when we move people from out of state to rural Alaska, it's not overly successful. And so while we look at out of state, we also got to figure out how to bring our own in, and that especially includes rural Alaska. And so those are things that we've been trying to do and looking at. We have what's called a talent acquisition team at the department level, and trying to figure out if there's things that we could do differently in our department to bring in folks. And we have not found the magic bullet as of yet, but we're continuing. But we have not dug into that quite yet either.
Follow up, Senator Tobin?
No, thank you, madam.
All right. I see no further questions on slide 5. We'll go to slide 6.
All right. So we are on part 2 of the HB 151 audit. Again, this came out in November of 2023, so 3 years after the first audit. This one came with 6 different recommendations. Again, I'm not going to read these verbatim, but what I will say is they were all done. So the first one talks about background checks and fingerprinting. We've trained on it. We've talked about it. We work with our partners on that. And that audit, for example, that came with whenever we place a child with a relative or a kin, we have to background check them. And then we have to follow up with fingerprinting. And so, you know, there was a few that were missed. What happens when you place a child at, 10 o'clock at night? We don't have people on the ground processing, but we work with our law enforcement partners who are usually with us in those type of environments. So some got missed. So we have gone back and made sure that that is taken care of. So that's just an example. The second recommendation here, our licensing packet, there were some delays in getting the training completed within our system. And so we worked on defining that differently and making sure that our applications were processed timely. So back when this audit was done, it was taking over 45 days. And so we have shortened that to make sure that we're under the timelines of 45 days. We're currently at 43 days, which I'd like to see faster, but it does take some time. And again, rural Alaska is a little bit more challenging because you have to fingerprint, and that requires us going out to some of these very rural areas, which we are partnering with our tribes in the tribal compact. If they have boots on the ground, they're going out and fingerprinting and doing the safety walkthroughs and things of that nature. So there's some good news and hope on the horizon. And I think that we can even shorten the 43 days moving forward. Recommendation 3 and 4 on here. Again, moving the applications faster, which we are doing. And number 4 on here, is working on our older youth and making sure they have the right documents when they're exiting care. So each youth has, they have standard documents, and then sometimes they have, for example, certification of Indian blood, CIB. So we work really hard to make sure they have their CIB cards, they have their Social Security cards, they have, birth certificates. Some of these we can't drive, such as like the Social Security Administration. You're only allowed to get your Social Security Administration card so many times. And we have people that go and sit in the Social Security office every week to try to make sure that we're getting this information, because there's been a lot of delays in the federal government. So we work with the youth. I have independent living specialists who work with the youth to find out what it is that they need. So it's hard to say like what percent this is complete or what percent is done. It's often if we hear something like, hey, I never got this, then we're backtracking and trying to figure out, okay, what did we miss? How did we not get that? But we have trained on it. We've talked on it. And this continues to be something that we work on.
Very good. Moving on then to slide 9. Or did we cover everything on 8?
Let's see. I'll quickly on number 8. Let me make sure I have the right one. So this is the one that I talked about earlier as part 1, as far as the certification of relative searching with the supervisor doing this. We just had some disagreements with the auditor on this one. We have all sorts of documentation that shows that we're doing it. The audit shows that we do have relatives. We're just missing the supervisor certifying it. So we were trying to get to the intent behind the law was the relatives, bring relatives to the table, get them documented. That is there. The certification is not there. And that was a conscious choice that we made because of the dollar amount that it's going to cost. And I just don't have the time to be redundant. My supervisors are carrying cases. They're spread too thin. This didn't seem like a good investment to do when I have evidence to show that we are doing relative placement. We're doing great compared to even the rest of the country on this. So, although room for improvement.
Senator Tobin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So curious, because obviously when this law was passed, there's an opportunity for you to come back to the legislature and say, I need these resources to comply with the law that you have passed. And was that conversation had at the finance table and they chose not to allocate those funds? What happened to the disconnect to create this checkbox?
Through the chair, Senator Tobin, I will say every year I come back and I talk about ORCA and our system is old. We need an update. I get questions like, how much is that going to cost? And I say $50 to $80 million. And that's typically where the conversation stops, to be honest with you. It's a big dollar amount. But every year in every legislative presentation I do, I talk about our system and like it needs to be updated. It's old. It's archaic. So that's, I would say that's where that, and I let my powers to be above me know also that this needs to be done. And we're getting a reduced federal reimbursement rate at this point. So all of these are shared. I'm fairly transparent about our issues and problems to anyone who will listen.
Follow up, Senator Tobin.
No, thank you, Madam Chair.
I will verify that I have heard the discussion about ORCA at least for the last 10 years. Yes. All right. Slide nine.
Slide nine. So the audit between part two and part three, there were around a year difference between part two and part three. So these were some of the efforts that we were working on in between when the auditor showed up again. Again, many of these are a little bit redundant of things that we were still pushing to implement. But we really have been trying to create pathways for promotion. We were working with our Department of Administration to create, before our line staff were PSS, Protective Service Specialists, ones and twos, we were able to get many of them into a flex position up to three. So we are trying to create a career ladder. So in rural Alaska, they're all flex positions. So they can come in as a one and they can max out at a three to be case carrying. In urban Alaska, they have standalone threes. And so there's a handful of them in urban areas. That was a 2-year project to get all of those reclassed and the permissions and things like that. So that was a big accomplishment by us, and our staff were super appreciative of this. So that was a great, great thing. Recruitment efforts, I've talked quite a bit about retention. We've updated all of our job descriptions. Recently, we have a staff advisory board that is comprised of people under supervisors all over the state. And so they meet on a monthly basis and they talk about issues that are important to them. I meet with them monthly, usually for the first, it could be 10 minutes or it could be the entire hour, depending on what they would like. And so one of the things that they had asked in 2023 was to create new recruitment videos. So the staff advisory and our department public information team created new recruitment videos. We had old ones on there, but they wanted more current, what felt like more updated. And so we do have those are on our website now. They're fantastic. I believe, as you all know, in 2021, we moved to competency-based hiring for the state of Alaska. And so what we did with that is we worked with the University of Denver to try to make sure that it was the University of Denver Quality Improvement Center to make sure that we had value-based questions. So if we weren't bringing people to the table that had education and experience, how do we know they've got the right value to work with vulnerable populations? And so those are some of the things that we've really been trying to hone in to make sure that we're hiring the right folks. I mentioned the relocation reimbursements that we're doing. We've done quite a few recruitment events across the state. We just had one here in Juneau last week. We've had some in Anchorage, just all over the place. We're trying to get into, and not just for staff, for foster parents too, Rotary clubs. We've met with the community of Pacific Islanders recently, talking to them. So we really are trying to get ourselves in front of a lot of people to talk about what we're recruiting for staff, recruiting for foster parents. Also, and I should have mentioned this earlier, one of the great things that we did with foster parents is we created a respite program. So what they were saying is we need a break sometimes, and sometimes we're going to want to take a weekend away. So we created a respite program. So we're recruiting people in to be respite providers to get their feet wet in the foster care world, and then maybe they'll want to be foster parents too, but we're creating a respite program to start. So that was really an exceptional thing that we lifted. We also started paid internships, and this was fantastic. We see anywhere from around 8 to 15 students at Office of Children's Services every year. That's bachelor's and master's degree, and it's all disciplines, social services disciplines for the most part, and that's been fantastic as well. So we're hoping to get even more this next coming year. And that's pretty much it on the retention effort. So we can jump to the next slide unless there's any questions.
Don't see any.
All right, now we're on to the part three of the audit. This was, it was completed in the fall of 24, and then the report was released in June of 2025. There were seven recommendations in part three of the report. The first recommendation, what has happened is we have 608 PCNs, our FTEs at OCS. And when there's vacancies, they sometimes can get lost because we're going to reshuffle. If we can't get, if we've done failed recruitment, we'll be like, okay, what? How can we centralize this? Can we do something different? And so we move positions around if we need to. And what ended up happening is our tracking, I was without an administrative operations manager for 8 months. So in those 8 months, we were trying to, 7 months, we lost count of some of these folks. We now have implemented smart sheets. So we've got that fixes like recommendation one and two. We were able to get that lined back in. Part of the discrepancy though is when, you know, they were, the audit was evaluating us in 2024, but they were looking back a year. So we couldn't reproduce what it was, because a lot of our data is point in time data, like it today, that's where this position is, but last year they may have been somewhere else. So there were some discrepancies in those times and be able to recreate what had happened a year past. So it's now fixed and we have formulas written out. We're using smart sheets. So I think, and I have an AOM, so it's fantastic. Recommendation three and four, during COVID, we went to an all online training. And even before COVID, part of our training was done virtual, like in a virtual platform. It was like through a staff development plan. And we also created a mentor team. Even before House Bill 151, we had two mentors, and then we created a whole team through the passage of HB 151, which was fantastic. COVID happened, and then coming out of COVID, we started doing some online training and some in-person training. And that online training isn't that they're just sitting in their office hitting next. It's where they're sitting together in a Zoom classroom, right? Many of the, for example, many of the master's in social work programs around the country now are virtual online platforms, right? So we're trying to mimic some of that. We do have in-person opportunities still. So we're still bringing people in. We were bringing them in 1 week of the 6 weeks. They get 6 weeks of training. And then our mentors are going out with our staff for two of those, in between those trainings, to what we call transfer of learning opportunities. So they're in the classroom, Zoom classroom, learning, discussing with the group. And then the following week, they go out with their mentor to try to solidify the things that they're learning as they go. We also have in-person forensic interviewing training for the staff that that's applicable for. If you're an investigator doing sex abuse cases, we do forensic interviewing training as well. So we've been trying to figure out the right approach to that training. We have a work group right now. We're working closely with the University of Alaska, the Child Welfare Academy, on trying to figure out the right mix of in-person versus not. What our staff have said is 6 weeks away from the family. Our workforce is predominantly female. 6 weeks away from your family is a long time. And so trying to figure out how we can navigate that to try to do some in-person and then some in the classroom, Zoom classroom, and then can we get people out to the regions so they can really learn how to do their job, practical applications of their job. And so I think that we're getting close. We're hoping to launch a new training come July 1. So we're excited about what that can look like. Recommendation 5 and 6, the talent acquisition team. Again, this was in 2024. We are just standing up our talent acquisition team. And so we're with any new project, we've run into a couple stumbling blocks, but we evaluate and we're trying to figure out how to make it more efficient and better. So that's a work in progress that we're continuing to look at. The last one on here, well, it's not the last one, there's one more, but OCS should have a 5-year workforce plan. That is one of your attachments. I'm sorry, I should have mentioned that earlier. There were some attachments that went with this presentation, but we do have a 5-year plan. There was some discrepancy with us and the editors. The law stated you should have a 5-year plan. We had a 5-year plan. They meant you should have a 5-year forward-looking plan. So we have changed that. It's now modified, so that's great. Recommendation 7, this was a little bit outside of our purview. They were recommending that Department of Health, there was a $10 million encumbrance and they wanted it released. And so of that $10 million, this was a few years ago, $2 million of that was OCS's dollars, but it was for a cyber attack that they're holding. That money, from my understanding, has not now gone back to general coffers. It's not not being expended.
Good. I see no questions. That takes us to slide 14.
Yes. So audit, there were recommendations. In audit 3, the auditors contracted with public consulting group, PCG. And so PCG came out with some recommendations. The next two slides are kind of what their recommendations. And some of them we have already done. For example, the job descriptions to make sure that they're they have the competencies and credentials. We do not have credentialing, but we do have the competencies and the realistic job profiles. We've updated all our position descriptions and the videos that we've done. The hiring, streamlined hiring process, that is not within our control, right? That we have administrative code through the Department of Admin about Workplace Alaska, how all these things have to work. There's lots of steps. Unfortunately, that is not something that we've been able to implement because it's, again, outside of OCS's control. That's probably the 4. Yep. So this next slide, slide 15. This was from PCG, and this was their recommendations that came out that we felt were important to share. They aligned with some of the things that we're seeing, and so you'll see the first two things on there: increase pay and reconsider Tier 4 retirement and defined benefits retirement. I think those are some huge ones from us. Some of the ones that we do have control over is, you know, we've had letters of agreements in the past, and we're exploring the use of letters of agreements again. We use traveling workers now. We've had to get creative. And so in some of my role locations, for example, they do week on, week off. So they go up and do 2 weeks worth of work in 1 week, and then they get the next week off. So we could look at doing that. Comes with some challenges as well as benefits, right? But the GGU union, ASEA, they did pass 8 different schedules that we could look this year. So we're super excited to dive into that a little bit more. So that's good news for us.
Senator Myers, a question?
Yeah, thank you. So you've got a section here that says review equity between unions. How many unions do you deal with, and what is the inequity between them?
Through the chair, Senator Myers, great question. We just have 2 unions. We have the GGU and the Supervisors Union. Mm-hmm. And there is some inequity. For example, my supervisors are being compressed. And so our line staff, the GGU union is typically a little bit, how do I say, our problem is with our supervisor staff, because people do not want to promote into supervisor positions anymore because it's almost like they're losing They're losing money to move into the supervisors union. You have to work more hours in the supervisors union. You don't get overtime as a supervisor, even though you're required to work overtime. And so that those are some of the inequities. And what we're seeing is, for example, I've had a vacancy here in the Juneau supervisor, family service supervisor for almost a year. It'll be May, it'll be a year. In Anchorage, I'm sitting with three vacancies in supervisor positions, so I haven't been able to hire for quite some time. People just don't want to promote at this point, and so that's problematic. So the compression is, and the inequity is some of the things that they're feeling.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Senator Klayman.
So when I just want to make sure I understand your use of the word of compression, you mean that you have positions and you can't fill them, so the number of supervisors you have is compressing?
Through the chair, Senator Klayman. Yes, and the pay, right? Like a lot of times people focus in on the field staff, right? But they don't think about the supervisor and managers that are needed to do the work. For example, our workers are not allowed to make removal decisions without staffing with supervisors or managers, right? So if you're at 10 o'clock at night and a worker is out there doing that work, they have to be able to staff with supervisors to make these bigger decisions. And so, they're just, you know, the pay is just not commensurate with what the GGU is getting.
Gotcha. Cool follow-up, Senator Klayman.
So does that mean if we, the legislature, are to look at specifically at staffing, at pay levels in OCS, we actually need to not just be looking at pay levels in a general sense, but specifically at a supervisory level and a supervised level as opposed to supervisor, both need review?
Through the chair, Senator Klayman, yes, I would say it needs to be reviewed.
Senator Tobin.
Thank you, Madam Chairwoman. So I appreciate seeing these best practices from the third-party auditor, but I'm curious from your perspective, what are things that we should be doing as lawmakers to improve work conditions, ensure that we're retaining quality staff and that we're recruiting high quality staff as well?
Through the chair, Senator Tobin, I think part of this is pay, right? And their benefits package, like whether that's a retirement. I often, you know, when there was a comment last week at one of the hearings, like, are we public safety? Are we healthcare workers, right? Like, where do we fall into that? Mm-hmm. Because we don't get treated as either one of those, right? And so I don't know where we would fall in that, but that's one of the things I think that would be beneficial is deciding what it is that we are. And I'm going to speak broadly, and the commissioner could definitely, acting commissioner can add into this. Our department is unusual, right? When we broke off from Department of Health and Social Services, one of the things that made Department of Family and Community Services is that we are public facing. So when you're talking API or you're talking juvenile justice or you're talking working with our seniors at the Pioneer Homes, we don't telework. We don't get to, when there's the weather is bad, we still have to show up, right? If a child is unsafe at midnight, we have to respond. And so that is, we are different than many of the departments out there. We are different. We're different than the DMV or DNR. I don't know where we fall in, but it just doesn't feel like we're falling in the right category. Like, I don't know if we're public safety or DOH. I just think that we, and OCS, I'm one division, but our other divisions also struggle with, losing people to teleworking agencies or things of that nature. So I think part of it is, like, how do we define what's important for the state of Alaska and how do we then align it and compensate it accordingly? And the last thing I'll add is, you know, and this is a bigger Alaska issue and an OCS issue, is how do we celebrate the good things that we do, right? How do we get media out there talking about it? Because I think a lot of times what you hear, well, I can't remember the last time a story was published about something good, right? And there are some great things that are happening out there. There's great people doing great work. There's tribes stepping up left and right. But we often don't hear any of that stuff. And so I think that changing the narrative about how important it is to do this kind of work, maybe more people would come to it and feel drawn to it if it was celebrated. If you asked any OCS worker where they work, I'd be willing to put a bet on they wouldn't say they work for OCS. They would all say, I work for the state. Because people are, they're afraid what they're going to get. Because people aren't like, you know, oh, they typically are not thanked for what they do. Like, oh, I have a friend and you guys ruined their family. Or so, you know, I like really trying to figure out a way to celebrate the good work that does happen, right? And I also want to acknowledge that we have plenty of room for improvement too, so.
Follow-up, Senator Tobin.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chairwoman. And I just think about this as I myself explored a social work degree. Human services was very fascinating to me, but it is very soul-sucking in many ways. And I know you and I have had conversations around, is there a way to kind of thread in the aspect of mandated supporting within a casework? If you as a caseworker didn't just have to be there to take children away, but you could be there to offer services, there's something that people need to have their soul fed in a way that some of this work just isn't going to provide. So I will definitely follow up with you offline about how we might be able to reimagine some components of the work.
That'd be wonderful. Thank you.
I see no further questions on this slide. So to slide 16.
Last slide here is just kind of what we identified. It's not the specificity, but it's kind of high level. What we're looking for is people to come and stay at OCS. We need qualified applicants to fill the vacancies. We need to expedite our hiring process. It takes quite a while to get in through the state of Alaska system. We need targeted recruitment to try to improve folks coming to child welfare. We need better technology. And lastly, which big emphasis on this, we need to build a continuum of care of prevention in our state. OCS, I always think of what we do on a spectrum, right? We're on a curve here. We're way over here, all the way down the river, catching all the ones that have come through. There's so many opportunities for people to help families before they come to OCS, but we're not doing enough, right? And so we've got to invest in prevention, secondary prevention, and primary prevention. So we see less and less families coming into OCS. We are seeing less kids come into custody. We currently have 2350. A couple years ago, we were almost at 2,900. So we are seeing a steady decline, which is fantastic. I did attach some data, five-year trend data in your packet as well. So there are some good things that we're doing. And I also wanted to highlight one great thing that isn't that I just want to shout is we are leading the nation on children reunifying with their parents. Now, it takes us longer than what it's taken the national average to reach permanency, for sure. But what we're seeing is children are going home to their parents and they're staying home. They're not coming back in much higher than anywhere in the national. I think nationally, children are coming back into care at 8%. In Alaska, they come back in at 9%. So it is a little bit higher. But when children reunify, they're better for it. And fiscally speaking, it's better for our state as well. We spend an awful lot of money in adoption and guardianship subsidies to the tune of $47 million a year. And so, you know, every time we really invest in getting that child back home means that they're staying home and it's better for them. So I'll end on that.
Very good. Thank you. Questions? Did you have a question?
I do have a question.
I couldn't tell that you were pointing to someone.
Yes, I apologize.
Senator Tobin.
Thank you, Madam Chairwoman. So one of the things I think we did not cover and I'm just curious about is students who are in moving into higher education or who are out of maybe a foster care placement or they're older. And I know that there's been some media coverage, particularly about a loss of a position that supported these young folks, the higher ed position. Can you speak a little bit about what is your anticipation or work that you plan to do to support those communities, especially as we know HR1 changes are definitely making it difficult for folks who are nearing that age of aging out?
To the chair, Senator Tobin, that was an unfortunate event. It was not planned out. And what I mean by that is there was a human resource issue that occurred in July of this last year. And school starts for our college educated children that are adults that are going to college. And so we had to pivot quickly. And so what we did is we took it back internally because we didn't have an option. It was better than nothing. And so we're exploring what our options are next year, including working a little bit closer with the university and trying to navigate how to help our young adults that are attending college. And so that's one of the things that we are looking at. But it was never our intention to take that back. It was an unfortunate event that occurred. Mm.
Follow-up?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'll definitely follow up with offline as I'm very concerned about this particular population.
Yeah.
Further questions, Senator Myers?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. So you mentioned the number of kids in your system has gone down, which is generally good, but I'm going to play just a little devil's advocate here. People are having fewer kids, and there's fewer kids in state, and so, you know, we've talked about that a lot lately with regard to things like school enrollment. Mm-hmm. How is your number of kids that are in your system tracking with overall population trends as well? You know, are your numbers going down because you're doing a good job, or are your numbers going down because we've got fewer kids in general, I guess is kind of what I'm getting at.
Through the chair, Senator Myers, great question. I don't think, and I haven't done a tight analysis on this, but what I will say is we're actually getting more reports of concern on children.
Oh.
And so last year it's nominal. I think it's a couple hundred more reports this last year than we had the year before. So our reports are still the same. So if the number of children are shrinking in our state, there's still quite a few that they're people that are concerned about the children. I will say that it's around a third of our calls are new families to us. And so that means two-thirds have anywhere from two to many reports of concern on them. So it's infrequent that we have new-to-us families. It's usually often families that we know about that are in the system in numerous ways.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Further questions? All right. Seeing none. Thank you for this presentation. I certainly know how difficult this job is, and burnout and support for staff. These are critical things to address. So thank you for what you're doing.
Yeah.
Any closing remarks?
Sure. For the record, Tracy Dompling, sorry, acting commissioner. I actually wanted to thank the committee for listening to what we had to say, having some very thoughtful questions to present in a way that I think was very respectful to Ms. Guay. She has a really tough job. And I thank you, Madam Chair, for recognizing just the hard work that comes within this field. And so I just want to thank you guys. This was a great opportunity to share information.
Very good.
Yes, thank you.
Well, thank you. With that, that ends our agenda for today. So our next meeting will be on March 5th, Thursday. At that time, we'll be hearing from Covenant House Youth Advisory Board on their board policies related to youth access to essential services and system accountability, particularly as it pertains to workforce capacity. The second item on that agenda will be Senate Bill 193, Naturopaths, and we will be taking public testimony on that bill at that time. So at this time, the agenda is concluded, so meeting will adjourn. Let the record reflect the time is 4:28 p.m.